This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Jim Stewart. Mr. Stewart served as an MP in Vietnam, and he is the author of the award-winning book, The Angel from Vietnam. Today is August 28, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech. And Mr. Stewart is joining me by phone from Imperial, California. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin, if you don't mind, if you could tell me a little biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
Born on October 24th, 46 in Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
Well, my parents, my dad was Frank and my mom was Catherine, and Dad worked at the Chrysler Auto Plant in Newark, Delaware. We didn't live in Wilmington. We lived in Newark, and then we moved out to the countryside of Maryland. But my mother, as typical in those days, was a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they didn't have much of an education, either one of them. Both of them had to drop out of school in the seventh grade because of the hardships they were having with their family. And
yes, sir.
No college or anything like that. Didn't even finish high school.
Right. All right. So did you grow up in Delaware?
No, I don't even remember Delaware. We moved to Maryland, the countryside of Maryland, when I was 5 years old.
Okay.
It was only about 7 miles from where we had lived in Delaware. We were right on the border of Delaware, Maryland, and Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir. All right. you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have an older brother, Frank, who's, I guess, 72, and my brother Bob unfortunately died several years ago from complications of diabetes.
Okay. All right. Well, could you tell me a little bit about growing up and what that was like for you?
Well, you know, I really touch on that in my book, and the reason I wanted to touch on that in my book is not too many people believe that we actually grew up with so much innocence. I think one of the things that my personal opinion that made us so great was that we were all alike. None of us really had much money, and we all seemed to work. The parents worked at DuPont's or the Chrysler or General Motors and things like that. And I know my stepson doesn't believe that I grew up, you know, cutting tree branches off of trees to whittle myself rifles to play army and stuff like that. It's, you know, now when I was commenting to my wife the other day that we seem to shop every day, and I told her, I said, one of the things I remember when I was growing up was all the stores were closed on Saturday and Sunday, and if you didn't buy your food, go shopping on Friday night, which is the night everybody went shopping, you know, you wouldn't have any food over the weekend. But it was just a real innocent time, and I'm so glad that I grew up in the countryside and had my neighbors and friends and could leave the door, you know, mm-hmm. unlocked during the day, didn't have to take the keys out of the cars. And like I say, my stepson doesn't believe that stuff like that actually happened, because it seems like there's a lot more crime and a lot more mistrust going on these days.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about what you did for fun as a kid? I know you talked about in the book that you're really interested in music.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid growing up, I had a neighbor to the left of me, D. Clay, mm-hmm. and a farm across the street that the Kerrs lived in. And when I was growing up, it the order of the day was just to you were either in the house or you were out. I remember my mother say, in or out, because you didn't want to let the flies in the house. So mm-hmm. we spent all day outside. the mothers would make us brown bag lunches, and we would hike off into the woods and go down to the streams and catch frogs and play army, make forts. I don't know if you've seen the movie Born on the 4th of July. In the beginning, it was sort of like that.
Yes, sir. Right.
We had a fairgrounds not too far from us that I remember we used to walk to the fairgrounds for the horse races and things like that, and I can recall as a kid that it was so far to walk, and we were so tired when we got back. But when I recently revisited my home several years ago, it was like a quarter of a mile down the street.
Right.
Well, we basically stayed outside, and then one day my neighbor got a guitar, and I don't remember how old he was when he got it, probably 12 or 13, and once he got a guitar, then I had to have a guitar, and my parents didn't have much money, so they got me an old guitar that was, the neck was all warped and I could barely hold the strings down, but I was eventually able to learn to play with my buddy, and I got a better guitar, and we played in a rock and roll band in the 50s, late 50s and early 60s together, and really had a blast doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I still love the that music from that era.
Oh, absolutely, right. you mentioned rock and roll, but could you talk a little bit more specifically about what kinds of music you would play?
Well, you know, we did a lot of instrumentals. Back in those days, it was very hard to find like an electric bass player. Mm-hmm. I remember one time we had a bass fiddle player in the band. But we eventually were able to get a group together that was sort of like an all-star group from, there was a group called Scotty and the Rockets and a group called the Cyclones, and then there was D&I, and we seemed to, we got together and formed a group called the Sabres, and we were really quite talented, and we did a lot of Roy Orbison stuff, and a lot of the Beatles, the Beach Boys, everything that was on the pop charts, we mimicked, and, like I say, we were quite good. As a matter of fact, D. Clay never stopped playing music once the band broke up and I went into the Army and things, and he kept playing music up until today.
Okay.
I'm not in touch with the other band members, though.
Mm. All right. Excuse me.
We'd play at all the local bars and Army bases, Aberdeen Proving Ground and Bainbridge Naval Training Center and places like that.
Okay. All right.
Actually, we were actually on TV twice.
Oh, wow, okay.
There was a show out of Philadelphia called the Chief Halftown Show,
mm-hmm.
and it was a talent show, and he had it on every Saturday morning, and he was an actual Indian, and he wore his war bonnet and everything. Really a great guy, and he had us on the show a couple times.
Okay, all right. outside of music, what other interests did you have?
Excuse me. Well, I was big into baseball.
Okay.
My dad coached my little league team, and I was a lot bigger than the rest of the kids. I think I was 6 foot by the time I was 13.
Oh, wow, okay.
I was a real good little league player. I hit 16 home runs in 14 games 1 year, and then I started to play pony league ball, and the pitching got a lot better, and I got a lot worse. So we played a lot of pickup games in the neighborhood, and usually our folks would have to drive us to a field or someplace,
mm-hmm.
and we played a lot of football and when I was growing up, and not too much basketball, but baseball seemed to be the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
A couple times we went up to the old Connie Mack Stadium to watch the Phillies play.
Okay.
D. Clay and his dad.
Right.
But basically it was just being outside, and you know, when I got into the teens, it was all guitar, night and day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, at this point as a kid, did you have any interest in the military at that point, or was that something that came about later?
No, I think back then, no, the kids didn't give it a second thought.
Mm-hmm.
I was not the greatest student. I spent all my time playing guitar and, excuse me, but I'm catching a cold, and I would stay out late, you know, playing in a bar or a club or something, get in at 2 o'clock in the morning and not get up and go to school. I graduated with like a D minus average. I had a quarter of a credit to get me through school, and I think the only reason they graduated me is was because of the death of my father.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was ill, that took a lot out of me too, and I didn't feel like doing too much, but just education to me wasn't important. It was just playing the guitar.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I know in the book, very early on, you talk about the importance of your father and the sickness and his death. Would you mind talking a little bit more about that and
no,
kind of what happened?
He fell off his bike at work, and he got a black and blue mark on his leg, and the thing got really big, and it wouldn't go away, so he went to the doctor and had a check, and he found out he had leukemia. And of course, back in those days when you had leukemia, that was an absolute quick death sentence. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I watched my father, you know, wilt away from a strapping, you know, 6'3", 195 pounds to about, oh, I guess when he died, he couldn't have weighed any more than 115 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one of those things. He got to the point where he would go to the bathroom in the bed, and we'd have to change him and things like that. And it was pretty hard time.
Yes, sir.
And I think I was 17 when he got the leukemia, and 18 when he died. And so I never really got to know the man. He was, very, very strict with us. He's strict, but he was fair, and that's what I liked about it. And I look back on it with, with great respect, because he, he did what he could with what he was given, and, God rest his soul.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. and so the next year, when you were 18, is when you joined the Army? Is that...
Well, I got out of school, and... I kept playing. The band broke up. It was funny. Not funny, but our lead guy, he was our lead singer. He played saxophone. He played bass. He sounded exactly like Roy Orbison. It was amazing.
Hmm.
He had an affair with a woman, and he confessed to his wife, and he turned to religion, and he just quit the band.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all shocked, because we thought we were going to get like record contracts and things like that.
Mm.
And so the band just fell apart, and I got hooked up with some other bands. I think one was called the Emeralds, and I played with them for a while, and I don't remember the name of the other band, but it got to the point where I wasn't accomplishing anything, and I wasn't working other than the band, and I just decided one day, hey, I think I'll join the Army. So
mm-hmm.
that was basically it. I was a big, fat kid, out of shape, and undisciplined, and just went down to the Army recruiter, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, looking back on it and trying to think back on it, if somebody would have said Vietnam to me, I would have said, what's that?
Right, okay.
Because, the kids back then... we didn't read the newspapers. The only thing I read in the newspaper were the box scores of the baseball game.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. What year is this? What year would this have been?
I went in February of '66.
Okay. All right. Had you? You said you weren't really aware what was going on in Vietnam. Had you paid attention at all as a kid growing up to the Cold War or anything, though?
No.
Okay.
No, just other than the drills of hiding under your desk.
Right.
Never gave it a second thought.
Right. What was it that appealed to you about the Army?
I can tell you I haven't a clue. I don't
okay.
think anything appealed to me. It's just that I knew that I had to do something, and I thought, well, there's the military. Both my brothers were in the Air Force.
Okay.
And I don't know why I didn't choose the Air Force. I haven't a clue.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, maybe it was because the Army recruiter was right in Newark and next to the bookstore, and I just went in and gave it a try, and next thing I know, I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm. All right. What did your family think about your decision to join?
Well, my dad was dead, of course.
Mm-hmm.
My brother, Bob, was still in the Air Force. My older brother, where was he? He was down in Florida or something. And, of course, my mother crying and everything.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's probably one of the reasons I joined, to get away from Mom.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Let's see. So how long into after joining was it that you became aware of what was going on in Vietnam?
Excuse me. Well, I went to basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I joined to become a military policeman. So after that, I went to the Military Police Academy in Fort Gordon, Georgia. And after that, they gave out the orders, and some guys went to Germany, and some guys went to Korea, and they told myself and a bunch of other guys, get on this bus. And we got on the bus, and we drove down from Fort Gordon to Fort Benning, Georgia, not having a clue. They wouldn't tell us where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
A clue where we were going, and we get out off the bus at Fort Benning, and everybody's got green T-shirts on, and we thought,
mm-hmm.
aren't green T-shirts worn by the guys in Vietnam?
Right.
So we realized then that we were being formed as a new, brand new company of MPs to go to Vietnam, and we were going to go through what they called counter guerrilla warfare school.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, before getting into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about your basic training and kind of your induction to the Army, and what was that like for you, if you could.
Well, I was. If you've ever seen Full Metal Jacket?
Yes, sir.
I was, what was the, Pyle.
Okay.
I was Pyle. As a matter of fact, I had the same body shape as Pyle.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably do the same amount of push-ups as Pyle, which was none.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a mess. And being that I was a mess, I got rode by the drill sergeants. I mean, they even assigned a guy to me to, after we were done for the day, we would go out and do extra PT. So I could manage to get through the monkey bars, which I couldn't do, and do the push-ups. And that's what I got for playing music all through my teens instead of going out for the football team and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So basic training for me, I kept my mouth shut, and I made it through. And, God, I think when I came out of basic training, I only weighed 210. Now, I'm really a big frame. I weigh 240 right now, and,
mm-hmm.
and people look at me and say, what do you weigh, about 190? I look thin.
Right.
And I'm just a big man. And I came out in great shape, and I loved it. I loved the shooting because I was I didn't mention this when I was a kid. I used to love to go groundhog hunting and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I got through basic with my mouth shut, and looking back on it, I loved it.
Right. All right. As far as the shooting, what kind of weapon were you training on? Was it an M14 or an M16?
Yeah, we trained on the M14.
Okay. All right. And you talked a little bit about just the difficulty of basic, but could you talk a little bit just about how the instructors would enforce discipline and that type of thing?
Well, basically it was, I don't think any of us were used to screaming.
Okay.
And, you know, they'd scream their lungs out, you know, God bless them, at you, and, drop and give me 20. And it was all done with the best intentions. They were taking a bunch of kids who were spoiled, lazy, undisciplined, and you don't do that by saying, would you kindly do some push-ups and, hey, you guys want some cupcakes and things like that. They have to use some kind of vocal force on you. And I don't think I ever remember a drill sergeant touching anyone,
mm-hmm.
but they were in your face, and they broke you down to build you up. And, I would recommend it to all the young men today,
mm-hmm.
every one of them, because I think we all need that to realize that, we aren't as disciplined and aren't as hot and as we think we are.
Right, sir. All right. I know you mentioned in the book, you talked about it was difficult in basic, but at the end of basic, your drill instructor was pretty friendly to you. Is that correct?
Yeah. Once you got into your last 2 weeks, everything sort of changed. But
mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you, when you first get off the train and set your foot on in front of a drill sergeant, it was something else. You know, the haircuts are done for a reason too. That you're not allowed to talk to your parents until right after you have your hair cut.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, after you get your hair completely taken off the top of your head and you look in a mirror, I don't care who you are, that's a shock in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they do that, they say, now go talk to your mothers. And we all go out and talk to our mothers, and as soon as we say our first word, we all break down crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from then, I think everybody started to realize that, hey, you know, you're in the Army now, and you join this, and, you're going to have some discipline instilled in you, and
mm-hmm.
you are on your way.
Right, right. The drill instructors that you had, were these guys, were they Vietnam vets?
I really don't know.
Okay.
Let's see, 66? There probably could have been mm-hmm. one or two, but I don't recall if any of them really were.
All right. So did you find that the training then was pretty sufficient as far as preparing you for what was to come later on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I went from 255 worth of fat to 210 pounds,
mm-hmm.
How many weeks was basic? 8, 9 weeks? I mean, that's pretty dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
And, I came out walking upright
mm-hmm.
with my head in the air, and not arrogant, but I just felt proud, as I'm sure a lot of the guys did, that, you know, they actually got through it. And, you come out with your Class A's on, and you're looking strike, and oh, yeah, basic training was great.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I don't know how it's changed today. I understand that the Marines have taken out the Crucible, and I'm going, wow, why'd they do that?
Mm, right. All right.
Maybe it's a kinder, gentler basic training. I don't know.
Maybe.
And I know today they have, don't they have pre-basic training physical training or something that you don't get to go in unless you're in. You can do so many push-ups and sit-ups, and they'll condition you first.
Right. I believe I have heard that. Yes.
And back then, you just went in, and if you couldn't do a push-up, they'd make you learn how to do a push-up.
Right. Yes, sir. All right.
And they did it by screaming at you and humiliating you until you thought, well, I'm going to do this and show these guys I can do this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, any memorable or humorous moments that kind of stick out in your mind that you could talk about?
From that? Basic?
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, I can't tell you because I never went off base. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in the last week or something they gave us leave and I didn't go.
Okay.
But, boy, you really
draw
my memory on that one. I can't come up with that. I know I got pneumonia.
Okay.
And, I remember passing out in the food line. But, I'm sure if I racked my brains a little bit more, I'd come up with something. But
sure, that's fine.
I think we're all too scared to be funny.
Right. Okay. Well, so once you completed basic, where did you go from there?
Went down to Fort Gordon, Georgia, okay. and everything changed. As soon as we got out of basic, we were treated with a heck of a lot more respect. We didn't do as much PT,
mm-hmm.
and the reason we didn't do much PT in the Military Police Academy is because they expected us all to keep in shape. So you saw guys on their off time were out running and jogging and doing stuff, and military police was more of learning the sitting behind a desk and learning the code of military justice and learning to drive an M151 Jeep like they had in Vietnam and things like that. It was more of a schoolroom environment.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had PT twice a week. Where in basic training, you had it every day and in the lunchtime and at night.
Mm.
And we were just expected to keep in shape as military policemen.
Right. All right. And was this an MOS that you had selected? How did you end up at MP?
Yeah, I selected it because I didn't have a choice. I originally wanted to go into photography because I was always artistic and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, I'll go into photography and take pictures for my 4 years in the Army. But I flunked because of my inability as a scholastic scholar. I flunked the test for that and basically flunked the test for just about everything. And I also flunked my hearing test. And
right.
The recruiter asked me, well, do you ever think about the military police? And I guess that was the bottom rung, I guess. And I knew that my grandfather was a policeman in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and my brother had been a policeman in Wilmington. And so I thought, yeah, military police sounds fine.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my MOS.
Okay. All right. Let's see. You said that. So was this training then more relaxed in general? Was it not as much pressure?
Yeah, it wasn't. There was, don't get me wrong, there was a lot of discipline involved, but it wasn't the screaming and the yelling because we'd already been through that.
Right.
But they would do things like put you at a post out in the boondocks from midnight till 4 o'clock to see if you fell asleep, things like that,
Right.
But nothing like basic training. Mm-hmm. And if you screwed up, they'd make you take the wax off the floors with razor blades and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
If they found rust in your canteen during inspection, they were big on inspections, but it wasn't the yelling and the screaming and things like that.
Right. Okay. And what would be the punishment if say you were caught sleeping on guard duty?
Well, I don't know because I never did.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't know what they would have done. I don't know if they would have kicked you out of the academy or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I do remember the first night of the academy, though, that I went up to the second floor of our billet and watched a guy walk in and walk right out the back and jump off the balcony. I guess he didn't want to be there, and that was sort of strange.
Right. Right.
I think he broke his leg or something like that.
Okay. All right. Were there other instances where you could tell that people didn't want to be there? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is, were most of the guys in your MP class, were they volunteers or draftees or a mix of both?
You know, I don't know. I just remember that, you know, looking back on that day and age, most of the guys were respectful and, you know, you didn't see the me that you see today, and I know my rights and things like that. We did what we were told, and I got along with everyone. I don't remember any rabble-rousers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were all basically conservative, you know, good kids.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit more specifically about the things that they were teaching you that an MP's duties?
Well, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is like a penal code for a state. It has all the laws in it, and the book, from what I recall, manual was quite thick. So we would go into the classrooms and just, you know, go through the rules and regulations for arrest and search and seizure, and you were basically learning to become a policeman. So a lot of the police academies today, I'm a retired cop, a lot of the police academies are the same way. It's a lot of book work because you have a lot of laws to remember.
Mm-hmm.
So we did mostly that. And like I said, we had PT a couple times a week, and it was mostly just book work.
Right.
Learning
okay.
the laws.
All right. Let's see. And how long did this training last?
I think the MP Academy was 2 months.
2 months, okay. All right. And from there you went to...
Yeah, they put us on a bus.
Right.
Not all of us. Some guys got to go to Germany and Korea and stuff, but the busload of us went down to Fort Benning, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
where the airborne school is.
Okay.
And we went through counter guerrilla warfare school. We actually formed the 552nd MP company there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bunch of guys taken from other MP units or whatever, or who had just gotten out of the academy, and we formed up there and went through a lot of ambush training and checkpoint training. And one thing we did do there was we did a lot of PT, but everybody was so in such great shape that, you know, we all loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And we went and saw how the firepower worked in Vietnam. We actually went to a village and watched them set off 50-gallon drums of gasoline around the perimeter, and watched choppers come in and attack the attack and things like that. So it was basically an introduction to what we would see once we got to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
We would run convoys out in the boondocks in Georgia, and they'd take us out into the woods in Georgia and drop us off and say, you know, you got to find your way back to camp, but don't use the road. If you use the road, you know, you're going to be doing push-ups all day long. So
mm-hmm.
things like that. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I think I remember you mentioning in the book, did you kind of have a feeling that that this extra training that you were receiving to go to Vietnam make you kind of feel a lead, I guess, compared to other MPs that were going to Germany and places like that?
Well, I remember we used to run in formation. There was a big blacktop track in front of our we stayed in like, God, it must have been three or four story villas or something like that, and there was a circular track in the middle, and the 139th MP, I don't know if it was company or detachment, billeted there too. And I remember that when we ran around the track in formation every morning, we'd sing out, "If I had a yellow spine, I could be in the 139." So
right.
Yeah, we sort of felt pretty cocky.
Uh-huh. Right. Sure. All right. So did you feel then that this training was pretty good as far as preparing you for Vietnam?
It was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was getting, you know, they put a lot of trust and faith in us, I think, at that time, because I remember that our orders were supposed to come in for our ship date.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Well, you guys find something to do." It wasn't like, "Okay, you guys are going to go out and clean this field and clean up the barracks and you're going to be doing this." They just said, you know, for the next, until we find out where we're going, you guys, you know, find stuff to do. And finally, it got to the point where they said, "You know what? You guys go on leave." So they let us go on leave, and I think some of the guys were gone for like 3 weeks. I had to—I forget—but I had to stay behind for some reason. But I remember playing baseball all day with my buddy for about a week or something, and then I went on leave too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess they thought they should be kind to us because we might not be coming back from Vietnam. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this unit, the 552nd. So you actually went over as a unit then.
Right. They flew us out to Oakland, I believe it was, and put us on the largest troop carrier in the world with nothing but Marines.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a company of Army, military, police, and about a gazillion Marines, and we took the boat to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Did that kind of give you a close sense of camaraderie in the fact that you had trained with these guys in the U.S. and then you're going over as a unit? Because, you know, of course, in most cases, you're going in as a replacement individually. So,
mm-hmm. So. Oh yeah, because I'm in touch with a lot of these guys today, and there's mm-hmm. there's even a website for the 552nd MP
mm-hmm.
Company.
Right.
And I would guess I'm in touch with at least 10 guys who served.
Okay. Well, all right.
As a matter of fact, I had a reunion with one of the guys who I hadn't seen in 41 years. He flew from Florida to Las Vegas on a little vacation, so I drove up to meet him. And there's a lot of camaraderie. I mean, when I started my website in 2002, the military police website, I started getting hits from some of these guys. Hey, do you remember me? I was with the 552nd. I go, oh yeah, heck, I remember you. And mm-hmm. some of them say, could you remember me? And I'd go, no, I don't remember you. But
right.
Oh yeah, we had a lot of camaraderie.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, as far as once you received those orders and you knew for sure that you were going to Vietnam, what did you think of that?
Well, you know, I still think that most of us didn't know a heck of a lot what was going on there. I mean, mm-hmm. we're still only 19 years old.
Right.
And how many 19-year-olds pick up the Philadelphia Inquirer or whatever in the morning and read the headlines? Not too many. Mm-hmm. Back then, there were, what, 3 TV stations?
Right.
The news was only on at, 5 o'clock in the evening? And so if you wanted to watch your news, everybody had to sit in front of the TV at that time. There wasn't 24-hour-a-day news, so I can tell you that I probably thought, okay, Vietnam, we're going, and there's a war going on, and don't know much about it, but here we go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Could you talk a little bit about the transport ship ride over there? I know you mentioned being on board with all those Marines and kind of what that was like.
Well, it was sort of funny because we decided that we were going to set the tone. And so we started doing exercising on the deck of the ship. And
right.
It was sort of funny because you know what a jumping jack is?
Yes, sir.
We'd be doing jumping jacks, but the ship would be moving because of the waves.
Right.
So you wouldn't land in the same spot every time. And the Marines were having a blast with that. I mean, they were just all over us about that. But what it did is it made them all tear off their their shirts and get down on the deck and start exercising with us. So,
right.
And we landed in Okinawa, and that was our first duty as military policemen because we were assigned to keep track of all the drunk Marines on the beach. And boy, there were drunk Marines. I remember dragging guys out of bathrooms that had thrown up all over the place. And
oh, boy.
There was a sign, no swimming, you know, the water's contaminated, and there were Marines in there swimming, and we were dragging them out and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a lot of fun.
Right. How long did the trip take?
21 days.
21 days, okay.
Yeah.
And,
because what we did is once we got to Vietnam, we were up north. We offloaded the Marines, and I think it was Da Nang, and then we went along the coast down to the South Vietnam, and we offloaded at the Vung Tau Beach down in the south. So it was
right.
A long trip.
Yes, sir. Did that 21 days by ship, did that count towards your DROs?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, outside of exercising to compete with the Marines, what other types of things would you do to occupy?
Man, it was boring. The guys would play chess and play cards and just sit around. There was absolutely nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, watch the dolphins at the back of the ship.
Right.
And that was it. We were so glad to get off. We were just, oh, God, we can't wait to get off this ship.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like about a year.
Right. what was your first impressions of Vietnam upon arrival?
Well, you know, when we had to get off, we got into the typical landing craft that you see see on TV when you watch the old World War II movies and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. but we weren't given our ammunition. We thought, what the hell is this? You know,
right?
We're getting down in this landing craft and we're going to go land on that beach, and we don't have any ammunition for our M14s.
Mm-hmm.
They made us Turner magazines in or something, I forget. But once we got there, we saw a band up on the beach, and there were a bunch of Vietnamese girls in their traditional dresses with flowers and stuff. So it was pretty cool. We all got flowers put around our necks, and we got put on a bus and drove through the town and went to the air base and got on a C-137 and transport and took us up to Benoit mm-hmm. Air Force Base, where we were then got on another bus and went to the post at Long Bend. And we were just, you know, I remember it being hot, and but I didn't, you know, I'm not much of a complainer, so
mm-hmm.
it was pretty, very beautiful country. Mm-hmm. But our first impressions were just, we were so busy looking at everything and looking at people and looking at cars and, you know, hey, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just basically excited young men. Just.
Right. All right. So you said you're based at Long Bend?
Yeah, we okay. went to Long Bend, and we were going to replace the MP detachment that was there.
Okay. All right. Could you describe Long Bend and what the base looked like?
Well, when we got there, all we had was the mess hall was built, and the showers weren't built. The mess hall was up. So when we got there, we had to put up our tents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we spent all day doing that. We didn't have any showers because I remember that once we got our tents up, it started raining and everybody took their clothes off and went out and got wet with a bar of soap.
Right.
Because it would really pour because of the monsoons and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nothing there, so we spent a month filling sandbags to, you know, protect our tents, the perimeter of our tents, and building the shower facilities, and the whole month was just basically construction. We didn't do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to pass, an inspector general would come to come to our unit and, you know, give it sign it across, and this place looks good, and you guys are ready to start work, so.
Right, right. Okay. And during that time, was it fairly quiet as far as the enemy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We, I'll get into that about the enemy a little while
sure.
Later because I think what I'm going to tell you, you probably haven't heard from too many Vietnam vets, but, you know, we had to go out on the perimeter at night, and there was no perimeter. We just went out and laid in the sand.
Mm, okay.
There was, from what I recall, we didn't even have any wire up yet.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, but right in front of Long Bend was the main road to Saigon. So as we were out there at night, you could, off in the distance, 100 or so yards, you could see the lights from the scooters and the cars and
mm-hmm.
stuff going by. So even though we were scared because it was dark and every little branch that moved and stuff, you know, it kept us alert. And except for one or two mortar attacks and one which I slept through.
Right.
Yeah, I did.
Right.
It was amazing. But I, like I said, I flunked my hearing test.
Right.
And they took me in the Army anyway, so maybe that's why I slept through a mortar attack. I don't know.
Right.
But, no, we didn't have any problems.
Okay.
Well, I can remember one thing. I should have put this in my book. As a matter of fact, when I look back on it, I wish I could add about 50 pages to it.
Right.
We remember, I don't know how this happened, but there was a guy in our tent, and he left his mail out on his bunk, and somebody read it when he wasn't there, and he talked to his girlfriend about how every night was a horror, and the gun battles, and he didn't know if he'd be able to make it out alive, and we're going like, what the hell is this guy talking about?
Right.
Because we haven't even tested our guns at the range yet.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty funny.
Right, sure.
But I'm sure a lot of guys wrote home and the same stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right, all right. What about things like food and stuff like that? How was the food?
The food?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just Army Chow. I don't really recall.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Army Chow.
Right. Okay. All right. let's see. Could you talk a little bit about just about your specific duties within the company?
Well, once we started, and I hated it. Once we started pulling duty, we manned the gates, and we stood in front of buildings where the officers would meet. And, you know, we'd have to stand at parade rest and stuff like that. And I absolutely, we manned the towers around the perimeter of Long Bend. And I just hated it because we had just gone through counter-guerrilla warfare school, running convoys and practicing ambushes and all kinds of stuff like that. And it was like stateside duty. And I just hated it. So I guess we had been pulling duty. Let's see, we got there in September. Since November, and January came around, and they asked for volunteers for the 1st Infantry Division, and about 6 or 7 or 8 of us all raised our hands because we just wanted out of that static post duty.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And as a result, we got transferred temporarily to the 1st Infantry Division, which was starting a big push against the Viet Cong during Operation Cedar Falls.
Right. Okay.
But the duty at Long Bend itself was, you know, ceremonial taking and putting up the flag and stuff like that. Just
right.
Boring stuff. It wasn't what we were expecting.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, some guys loved it because they didn't want – some guys never left base all year.
Right.
Never went outside the base.
Okay.
Never went to the town of Benoit or anything.
Hmm. All right. Outside of your MP company, what other types of units were there at Long Bend?
Well, I remember the 11th Cav was around there someplace. It was a lot of support. Long Bend would become the biggest military base in the world, and Long Bend had Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Mm.
I mean, it was, for the time, it was plush.
Right.
And it was secure, and I didn't stay at Long Bend very long. Like I say, I was there pulling the static duty, then went with the 1st Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm.
After I came back from the 1st Infantry Division, I went to Benoit in town.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wasn't at Long Bend that long to get really familiar with what they had there, although I know the 11th Cav was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a lot of this buildup then took place after you were already you had already transferred out of there, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Because I only spent 3 months at Long Bend.
Okay.
And 1 month was building our own compound, and
then
I went with the first.
Right. Okay. Before we get into this, talking about your duty with the first there, I know in the book you talked a little bit about several of the personalities in the unit and some of the friends that you had made. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you were assigned, you know, platoons and tents, and what you did is you clung to those guys that were in your tent. To tell you the truth, you would get into like a little clique of about 10 to 15 guys, and you know, you would stick with them. I can actually say that there's some guys from the 552nd and looking at their website who I don't remember at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at their pictures and I don't even remember them because it's just natural for you to, you know, hit it with a small group and stay with those guys. And
right.
I remember one guy from New York was a singer and I was a guitar player. So somehow we found a guitar. I don't know where the guitar came from. And he started singing and I started playing the guitar. And eventually we had 3 guitars. And I don't even remember doing this. And a guy sent me a picture of me and 2 other MPs in our civilian clothes up on a little stage playing our guitars. And I can't even remember doing it. I thought, wow, that's really cool.
Right.
But we, you know, would entertain the troops and stuff. And of course, back in those days, it was introduction to drinking beer 101. You know?
Right.
So when we were off, a lot of the guys were in our little Playboy Club. Everybody had a Playboy Club. It was a tent.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the Playboy Club drinking copious amounts of beer.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That picture you just described, is that on your website?
The one with the guitar?
Yeah, 'cause I
will send it to you.
Okay.
I think I'm almost pretty sure it's on the website, and I have a page called The Deuce on my website.
Right.
And that's the 552nd.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
552, and it was called The Deuce, and I might have put it on that page.
Right.
But
okay.
If it's not there, I'll send it to you in the email. And by the way, when we get done, please send me another email because of my computer crashed and because of my Incredimail that I was using.
Right.
And I've gone back to Windows Mail, but I lost a lot of email addresses.
Okay.
I think I lost yours, so.
Sure, no problem.
Okay.
All right. okay. One other thing as far as your duty at Long Bend there. Was it Long Bend? I know you talked about it in the book. There was one instance one night when you were on guard duty and you thought you saw something moving and then there was a problem with the rules of engagement.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. You talk about political correctness, and I guess it even happened back then. My buddy and I were up in a tower, and this was an old tower left over, I guess, from the French days. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Quiet American with Michael Caine.
Yes, sir, I have.
Do you remember the tower that they got up in?
Right.
It was like that.
Okay.
Built out of concrete blocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we were up there, and my buddy could have sworn he saw a movement, and I could have sworn I saw a movement. So we just set off a flare. How innocent is that?
Right.
Oh, Jesus, you thought World War VI was starting. I mean, we had patrol cars down there. What the hell are you doing? You're waking up the 11th Cav, and they're on their way over here and shit. So we just shut off a flare. We thought we saw some stuff moving. So we got our ass chewed out for that.
Right.
That we had to call it in before we set off a flare. So
mm-hmm.
I guess we had to call it in before we'd shoot, too. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Was this part of the official rules of engagement then?
Well, we didn't know.
Right.
Had we known, we wouldn't have shot the flare off. But we
sure.
thought, hey, let's see, Vietnam, war, Viet Cong.
Right.
We're guarding the perimeter, see something move, set off a flare.
Uh-huh.
Well, the set off the flare part was the part that was wrong.
Right.
So we learned a lesson.
Uh-huh.
It also changed our attitude a little bit.
Right, sure, I would imagine so.
Like, you know, well, isn't that the shits?
Yeah.
You know, why give us the flares if you don't want us to set them off?
Right. So in any case, when you're up there in the guard tower and you're looking at, any time you see anything, you're supposed to call first before you do any make any action.
Well, that's what we took away from it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know if that included an outright assault.
Uh-huh. Right.
But you know, you got to laugh. But when you watch the movie Black Hawk Down and the guy gets down with his M60 machine gun and. He tells his, I think it was Lieutenant Colonel, they're shooting at us. What do I do? He says, well, shoot back.
Right.
So I don't know if the rules of engagement have changed or I don't know.
Sure. Were there other instances like this where you were on guard duty and, you know, possibly saw something out there?
No, it was, like I said, it was boring. I mean, Long Bend was a secure base. I mean,
right.
Aside from them blowing up the ammo dump twice, we never got assaulted
mm-hmm.
at all. They never attacked the base or anything.
Mm-hmm. So they blew.
I mean, you know, you could.
Go ahead.
We'll get into it later, but, you know, I could go off base and drive my Jeep into Benoit 7 miles away, you know,
mm-hmm.
and not even have my gun with me.
Right.
Although we always carried our guns, but I say I could do that and feel completely safe.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. All right. Okay, let's see. So you had been there about 3 months or so, you said, when you decided to volunteer for this convoy duty?
Yeah.
Okay. And where was that, where was the 1st Division at this point?
Well, the base camp was called Dian, D-I-A-N, but uh-huh. the Vietnamese D is pronounced with like Z.
Mm-hmm.
And it was where the 1st Infantry Division was located, and we got on a chopper and went up there, and... we were helping to, as soon as we got there, what was the first duty that we pulled was gate guard. And we went like, oh, geez, what is this? So we spent time out at the perimeter, and it was so funny because it was a little bit different than Long Bend because Zion, you know, got mortared and stuff like that, and it was more out in the boonies than Long Bend was.
Mm-hmm.
But my buddy and I decided to sit in the roadway. We put the Claymore mines out and pulled the concertina wire across the road, which is just a dirt road, and we're sitting there at 2 o'clock in the morning in our chairs in the middle of the road because we didn't want to be inside the sandbag bunker. And next to our bunker was a three-man mortar team from the 1st Infantry Division. And what they would do is they would get up during the night and just drop mortar rounds into the tubes and shoot them out on the perimeter just in case the Viet Cong were walking around. Mm-hmm. And they'd go back in their tent and go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd get up and drop a couple more mortar rounds in and fire them out. So I remember we were sitting there, two new guys, and watching these red things go over our head, not knowing what they were. And one of the first infantry guys said, "Hey, you guys might want to move." And we looked at why. He said, "Well, because they're shooting at you." And I said, "Oh, shit." So we got up very sheepishly and walked back in and stayed in the bunker the rest of the night.
Mm-hmm.
But we had no idea. We were new to this, and even though we'd gone through counter-guerrilla warfare school, you know, we hadn't seen anything at Long Bend, so why should we see anything at Zeon?
Right, right. All right. So how long after you got there to Zeon was it that you were finally able to go out on a convoy?
Well, it wasn't too long. We also got to pull guard duty at the prisoner of war. They had a little prisoner of war compound there, and that was pretty interesting because we got to see all the Viet Cong that they bring in the black pajamas and stuff. And a lot of them were women, and we'd look at the women and go, "Gosh, she's pretty. What the heck is she doing out there, you know,
mm-hmm.
killing people and stuff?" And we would guard that. But then we finally got to convoy duty, and convoy duty was just everything we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually rat patrol, you know, in action.
All right.
And we were excited about that.
Right.
And what we would do is we would escort munitions and supplies from the base camp at Zeon up to the Iron Triangle where Lai K, the base camp of Lai K, where they had a lot of artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other names of the places? But anyway, we'd escort all the stuff all the way up there.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have a gun jeep in the front and a gun jeep in the middle and a gun jeep in the back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long was the convoy? As far as how long was the drive, was it usually?
You know, I try to think back at how long it was.
Mm-hmm.
Convoys only drive at like 20 miles an hour.
Mm, okay.
15 miles an hour or something. So it took us a while. It was an all-day thing by the time we would get up there. A lot of times we'd stay in a tent, we'd stay overnight, and then we'd take the empty trucks back, you know, the next day. But it was an all-day affair, but it wasn't all that far. It might have been 25 or 30 miles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, boy, I'm just guessing on that one.
Right.
I just don't recall. It's been so long ago.
Sure, sure.
But we'd stop along the way. You know, we'd find a spot, and sometimes, and the guys would get some sodas and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
From a local Vietnamese store.
Right, right. As far as, I know you talked about being able to drive into Binh Hoa and all that in your Jeep and not having a problem, and then here on the convoy stopping on the side of the road and buying sodas and whatever, but how was the relationship with the Vietnamese and with just the average Vietnamese peasants, and what was your impression of them?
Well, at that time, for me, it was sort of standoffish.
Mm-hmm.
There were ugly Americans there, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall one time coming back from a convoy, and one of the MP gun jeeps had purposely gone out of its way to run through a mud puddle that would splash mud up onto these schoolgirls who were going to school. They all wore the traditional white, long alzais. They're very beautiful dresses.
Mm-hmm.
Just to purposely splash mud on them. And I remember the guys in my Jeep chewing some ass when we got back. But it was basically standoffish. But the kids loved this. The kids loved this to death.
Mm-hmm.
And it was polite and everything, but it all depended.
Right. Okay.
You know, and I hadn't had much contact with them up until that point anyway.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Right.
I got my contacts later with them when I, you know, moved into Saigon.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. And what was the general impression when you and I guess other guys in the unit would see the, you know, some of these guys being ugly Americans and doing things? What was the thought about that?
Well, I think probably we should have said more, but we just kept quiet, I think.
Right. Okay.
You know, just look at that asshole over there. Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay.
I guess because we had to work with these guys.
Right. Sure. Okay. Well, whenever you would go out on the convoys, was there ever any contact with the enemy?
Nope. Never got shot at once.
Okay.
And but that was the case for most of us over there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can remember that we had a breakdown in the convoy, and they dropped me off by myself at a bridge and said, guard this bridge until the rest of the convoy catches up. And it was getting dark, and I was standing there by myself, and I thought, somebody's going to shoot my ass.
Right.
So I stood down off the bank so they wouldn't see me. But other than that, no.
Mm-hmm.
never fired my machine gun at all.
Right.
Or my M79. And I can remember going past some guys with the 11th Cav on their tracks and stuff off the side of the road, and it looked like they'd just been in a firefight or something because the looks on their faces, told you all. But we're very lucky.
Mm-hmm. All right. I know you talked about in the book, it's got a little bit of a different view of the war, your story, and the fact that I think the average American who doesn't know that much about Vietnam, just what they've seen in the movies and maybe a few books. Yes, sir, those stereotypes were, and it's always a firefight, it's always a battle, so I guess it's pretty interesting that it wasn't always that way.
It was seldom that way.
Okay. All right.
I mean, you take a look at Long Bend. There are guys who went to Long Bend, and I don't know how many thousands of troops were at Long Bend. I don't know what to think. Who never left the base.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
Right.
For any reason. They just spent their entire year doing what their job was, whether it be a mechanic, motor pool, maintenance, storage, stocks, weapons, armory type thing, and they just never left the base, never heard of shot fired.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There were just far too many of the guys who wrote letters home, like the one we found on the cot that day, the bunk that day.
Right.
That said he didn't know if he would survive because of the firefights we were having at night, and we're going, what firefights is this guy talking about?
Right. All right. Well, what about as far as on these convoys, concerns about mines and things like that?
Well, it's funny that you, because I had a good buddy of mine from the 552nd, Doug Drager.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, when Doug got in touch with me through my website, he said, "Hey, I'm Doug. Do you remember me? We were, I was once on some convoys together and stuff." And I wrote him back and said, "Gosh, Doug, I can't remember you. I remember your face." He sent me a picture. And he wrote me back saying, "Well, that's funny because I can still remember your voice." And it's funny how that works with sometimes. And I was going, but anyway, we got reacquainted again. And he was helping me with the book because I would say, "Look, Doug, what was the name of that village across from Long Bend? What the heck was the name?" And he'd say, "Oh, that was, I don't know.
Right.
Ben Cat or something like that." And, he was helping me with some details, and I sent him a draft pages of the book, and he said, "Well, are you going to put in there when you ran over the mine?" And I said, "I ran over a mine?" And he was like, "You got to be shitting me." He said, "You can't remember that?" I said, "Doug, I can't. And what had happened, and I still have problems with it today, I'm trying to remember the damn thing. He said that there was a contact mine, and I had run over it on a convoy, and what had happened is it didn't go off, and it got caught underneath the front of the Jeep, and we pulled it out of the dirt in the road and dragged it, and it fell apart.
Mm.
And so that was the extent of that. But other than seeing things like that, I was never with a convoy that got attacked at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I know that you said that one of your other jobs back at was this at Zion when you were guarding the POWs?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit? I know I'm jumping around here a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about your impressions of them and what you thought of? I know you mentioned the girls, but just what your impressions of the VC were in general.
Well, we weren't we didn't actually go in the compound. We did the perimeter. All of that stuff inside was done by the intelligence people.
Okay.
But I do remember one little chap that had his shirt off, and up on his shoulder, there was a little indentation in his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like it had collapsed, and I had asked one of the guys, "What happened to this guy's shoulder?" And he said, "Well, he got that way from carrying a .50 caliber machine gun around."
Mm.
And the bar- and the 50 caliber must weigh, I don't know, 45 pounds, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he had the barrel sitting on his shoulder, and he carried it around for so long that it just it made a little indentation in his shoulder. But they were all small and wiry, and they looked pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can remember.
Right. Okay. Sure.
But I didn't have any contact with him or talk to him or anything like that.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, how long were you on this duty of working with the 1st Division in the Conference?
It's probably a month and a half.
Okay.
Because Operation Cedar Falls lasted a month.
Okay. All right. And after you finished that, did you return to Long Bend at that point?
No, I went back to Benoit.
Okay.
And the name of the compound that I was billeted in escapes me, but it was like a hotel where high-ranking officers who would land at the Benoit Air Base would come and billet.
Mm-hmm.
And we also pulled some town patrol.
Okay. All right. How long were you here at Benoit?
Probably a month, because after 6 months with the Deuce, I got transferred to Saigon. I guess they break up those companies so that they all don't rotate home at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and then they bring in new blood,
mm-hmm.
or the whole company would be going home at the same time because we all came together.
Okay.
So they transferred some of us out, and I left with Mike Ramirez and Jim Troop and Doug Draggart and a couple other guys, and we went to the 300th MP company in Saigon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that time that you were at, that month or so when you were at Benoit, was it mostly town patrols then?
Yeah, it was town patrol and guarding that one billet.
Okay. All right. And was town patrol something that you looked forward to as far?
Oh, yeah. It was just like being a policeman here in the States.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Same thing. There would be traffic accidents.
Okay.
You know, you'd have to do, you know, investigations and, of course, we spend most of our time just going into the bars and making sure that the drunk GIs weren't, you know, mm-hmm. beating up people or
right.
themselves.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay. One other thing I wanted to ask you, and I meant to ask you about this earlier with the convoys. I know you talked about a really sad moment in the book, in your experience, rather, on the convoys where you witnessed a little girl get ran over.
Oh, that's, yeah. What we used to do is at Zeon, we would have to go in. There was a little village. We'd have to take a deuce and a half truck in there in the morning and pick up the Vietnamese workers,
mm-hmm.
and then bring them back on the base. And we would go in a gun jeep, and I recall this one time I was at the back of this deuce and a half, and in the morning, everybody in Vietnam rides bicycles. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you were to see Saigon, it's just amazing. There's millions of bikes in Saigon, little motor scooters, things like that. But a schoolgirl was going to school, and the deuce and a half made a tight turn on the road, and she wasn't able to make it, and he ran right over her her head.
Mm. Right. How would the Vietnamese react to accidents like this?
Well, I remember being told, don't let anybody touch the body because we have to get an investigator here. And I remember the family showing up just hysterical, as they should have been.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And here I am trying to get them not to touch the body, and here they are wanting to pick up her parts and stuff like that, you know, pick up parts of her skull and stuff like that.
Right.
And I remember not liking to have to do that at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those. But they had seen, the other people that were there had seen enough of death and stuff. You know, the Vietnamese have been attacked for centuries.
Right.
That I wouldn't say they were numb to it, but
mm-hmm.
curious.
Okay. How often would things like this happen? Accidents and things like that.
Oh, there's you know, all the time. If you look at the, you know. The wall, there's 58,000 names. Well, something like 22 or 23% of the names of the guys on the wall weren't killed in combat. They were killed by accidents,
mm-hmm.
Car crashes, plane crashes, you know, heart attacks, you know, things like that. So, you know, when you put that many people and a lot of the people from the outer areas had moved into the towns. I mean, there was a lot of congestion.
Mm-hmm.
So accidents, yeah, accidents were frequent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's see. Okay, is there anything else we should cover on this time period before we talk about when you were transferred to the 300th MP company?
No, I think that's fine.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's see. Do you know why you were transferred, or was it just a random sort of thing?
Well, I don't know, because, like Doug Draggart, he spoke his mind, and he was a real good soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And but Mike Ramirez was straight as an arrow. Jim Troop, straight as an arrow. Myself, besides getting into trouble being the first to contract venereal disease in the company.
Right.
And the other guys, no, I don't, you know, who's to say? I mean, there could have been an officer there saying, you know, hey, let's get Stewart out of here or let's get Troop out of here. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But, you know, like Mike Ramirez was about as straight as you can get, and so was Jim Troop. So
mm-hmm.
maybe they just showed the name out of a hat. I don't know.
Because right.
not only did we get transferred, but other guys got transferred too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you feel about being transferred?
I think I was ready to go because I didn't want to be back at Long Bend.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I didn't want to wind up back there for the last 6 months. So I thought, Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Yeah, that sounds pretty cool.
Right. All right. Now, had you, I know you weren't based around there, but had you been to Saigon at all before that? Had you seen
no.
it at all? Okay.
No.
All right. Okay. Well, what was your first impressions of Saigon?
Well, it was like driving into New York City.
Uh-huh.
It's huge. It was congested. Lots to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, going from the countryside of Fair Hill and driving into New York City. And I hadn't seen too much of that anyway. So,
mm-hmm.
And motorcycles and bicycles all over the place. No rules of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty girls.
Right. All right. Well, what were your duties there?
300 MP Company was in charge of the Saigon port.
Okay.
And the Saigon port, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ships would come and dock there and offload all kinds of wares.
Mm-hmm.
And we were responsible for the security of the Saigon port.
Okay. All right. And so you were here for the rest of this tour?
I was there for 6 months.
6 months, okay.
Oh. For my first year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what would your daily routine have been like?
Well, get up, go down to the ports and pull. Here again, it was gate duty again and some mm-hmm. foot patrol. But it wasn't boring like Long Bend because there was stuff to see, people to interact with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and things to do. Rather than standing up in a tower and looking out over a vast area of nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Did you go on town patrols as well? Or?
No, 300 okay. didn't pull town patrol.
Okay. All right. Well, any memorable moments during this period? I know in the book you mentioned an incident with a guy bringing a grenade to you.
Yeah, and it wasn't really a big deal, and the only problem was I couldn't get the pin back in the grenade because either the spoon was bent or I think the spoon had to have been bent out of shape, and I just couldn't get the pin back in it. So it wasn't a big deal, and I just told the guy I was working with, the other MP, I said, I'm just going to go over, call explosive ordnance disposal. I'm going to go over and sit here, and, you know, and then they showed up, and next thing I know was I was being decorated for heroism and all that stuff, so it was pretty cool.
Right. All right.
And it was the Soldier's Medal, which is the highest medal for non-combat
mm-hmm.
heroism. So pretty cool. I've got mm-hmm. it up in my house mm-hmm. today.
Sure. All right. Any other memorable moments from that time?
No, with the 300th, not really. It was no.
Okay.
I know that after I got Soldier's Medal, and then I got promoted to Spec 4. They took me off port security and assigned me with a detail to guard, and I can't remember if it was MACV headquarters, but it was a little compound outside the main gate to Tonsonut, and it was just cherry duty. We could make our own hours. If you wanted to work a 12-hour shift, you could. If you wanted to work an 8-hour shift, you could. You just had to coordinate it with the other guys, the MPs that were working there. So it was great duty. I remember I worked it with Jim Troop. He was one of the guys assigned there, and the guy that I came over with from the 552nd.
Okay. All right. What about your housing in Saigon there at that time?
With the 300, it was a place called Tent City.
Okay.
And they were tents just like Long Bend, although by the time I left Long Bend, they had turned the tents into Quonset huts, the metal prefab things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the 300, they were still living in tents, and of course the tents were on wood, a wooden base, and you know you had your locker and everything, but no air conditioning, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. well, I know a major portion of your book focuses on your relationship to Mai.
Uh-huh.
And would you mind talking about that and just how that came about? And
well, I hadn't spent much time carousing after my experience with gonorrhea, so I basically was a good boy. But I was working the gate one night, and outside of the drop down bar for vehicles to come in, I was just standing up on the roadway one night because, if I recall, curfew in Saigon was either 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and everybody had to be off the streets. I mean, it went from congestion city to you could hear a pin drop.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was always rushing to get home at God, I want to say it was 10 o'clock.
Okay.
And I saw her go by in a Ciclo, and one night I stopped the Ciclo, which I had no authority to do, but I was an MP. Everybody, one thing about the Vietnamese, they all respected the MPs because they knew when the GIs got drunk, the MPs came and took them away.
Right.
So we got treated fairly well by the local Vietnamese. But I stopped her and got to know her, and the next thing I know, I had myself a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. From what you could tell, what do you think the general feeling was among the Vietnamese about the relationships between Vietnamese and Americans?
Well, they didn't like them at all.
Okay.
The Vietnamese men they really frowned upon it. And if you were seen together, like in a taxi, you definitely couldn't hold hands in public. You could get harassed by the local police or the Vietnamese MPs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I'm getting a little bit off subject here, but I know that there was an incident with the Vietnamese MPs. But before I get into that, I wanted to ask you if you had ever worked with the Vietnamese MPs before.
Let's see, with the 300, I don't think I worked with them in the 300. I think that once I came back to Saigon after my second tour is when I worked with them a lot. I actually had a good friend who was a Vietnamese MP.
Mm-hmm.
And I even went to his house and ate dinner at his house one time.
Okay.
But they were pretty good. The Vietnamese MPs were pretty good, but the local city cops could be quite corrupt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, could you talk about that incident that you mentioned in the book about?
Well, it was pretty simple. We decided one day to go to the zoo,
mm-hmm.
and we went to the Saigon Zoo. Now, not too many people would think that there is a zoo in Saigon during a war.
Right.
But people used to go to the zoo and look at the lions and the tigers and stuff. So we went to the zoo and spent half a day, I guess, at the zoo, and we made the mistake on the way back to our apartment of riding in the same taxi,
mm-hmm.
and lo and behold, we got pulled over at a checkpoint by, there must have been three or four city cops and two Vietnamese MPs, and they took her away.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She didn't have an ID. She had lost her ID somehow, and of course that made her a candidate to be a Viet Cong, and they took her away for a few days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And I can't remember in the book, did you say that you and her sister had to bribe them to...
Yeah, I had to take money.
Okay, right. Okay. Was that fairly common, things like that, as far as bribing and corruptions?
It always worked.
Uh-huh. Okay, right. All right.
There was a lot of money changing hands.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know that later on in the book you talked about, particularly about the black market and your work there, and I certainly want to talk about that a little bit more when we get there, if we could.
Uh-huh.
But at what point in your tour did you meet Mai?
Well, let's see. I went to Saigon in what? March.
Okay.
So I probably met her in March, late March maybe.
Okay. All right. Okay. How much time did you have left at the end of your initial tour?
Well, when you extend for 6 months.
Okay.
So I had, 5 months left, I would assume.
Ah, okay. Right. All right. Okay.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Let me back. I'm getting ahead of myself. That was my first tour, so it was March, and I would have gone home in September.
Oh, okay. Right.
But I wound up extending twice, 2 6-month tours each.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What made you decide to re-up?
Well, I didn't re-up in the military. I just decided not to go home and go to a base at the States. I enjoyed what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was with Mai, so I decided, I'm just going to extend, and I extended my tour.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you have to do to extend?
Just walk in and say, I want to extend.
Okay. All
and
right.
They say, sign here.
Right.
Because they like keeping you if they could.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, could you get your choice of assignment by doing that? Or?
Yeah, you could. I said, I want to extend, and I want to go down to Vung Tau and pull town patrol. Because I really wanted to pull town patrol. And Vung Tau was from what I had heard, was a place where you just pulled town patrol. Vung Tau was the in-country R&R center,
mm-hmm.
rest and recreation world. The GIs down south, would the southern port part of Vietnam would go there. The guys up north would go to, China Beach or someplace like that? I don't remember the name of it.
China Beach at Da Nang?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
It rings a bell, but I know there was a place up there that they could go to.
Okay. Right. All right. So this first initial, whenever you, not re-up, but extended, it was 6 months at a time, you said?
Yeah, when you extended, it was for 6 months.
Okay. All right. All right, and you were assigned to, was it the 560th MP Company?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Okay. Could you talk a little bit about Vung Tau and your impressions of it?
Well, Vung Tau was absolutely beautiful. It was right on the ocean. It was sort of the gateway for all the ships that would go up the Saigon River.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the French, you could tell that the French were there because of the architecture and things like that. It was a resort, not only the R&R Center for the GIs, but it was also a resort for the Vietnamese that would go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a nice place. but when I got there, I thought, oh, boy, I've got it. I've got town patrol now. And I wound up being put on ship security.
Mm-hmm.
That's riding ships and tugboats and things down into the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, man.
Right. All right. So was that was your primary duty?
They said you have to earn your way to town patrol.
Okay.
So everybody started on ship security.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get on a tugboat run by the civilians and pulling ammunition and supplies down in the Mekong Delta, and I would ride the tugboat down the myself and one other MP,
mm-hmm.
down to places like Mito and Kanto and drop off all that stuff and and come back, and you could be on the tugboat for, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One way?
No, down and back.
Down and back. Okay.
Or you could get put on a ship, which I had, which where I got mono, and you could get on that ship, huge ship. It might be a Hungarian ship. It might be a Spanish ship. Go up the Saigon River, all the way up to Saigon, and you and another MP would be the security for that ship. Then you'd have to stay on that ship 24 hours a day until they offloaded all their cargo, and that could take a week, 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And there had to be an MP on duty at all times, so two guys had to split 24-hour days.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated that.
Sure.
Oh, man.
Right.
That was awful.
Right. If you don't mind me asking, how did all this affect your relationship?
Well, you know, Mai came down to Vung Tau, and then all of a sudden we found this out, so she wound up going back to Saigon and living there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And I actually, I remember one time going up to Saigon on the ship, and I told my buddy, I said, hey, let's work a deal. I said, I'll work 24 hours if you work 24 hours. And he said, okay. So I took that 24 hours to get off the ship and go back to my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But I paid for it when I had to come back and work 24 straight hours.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Right.
Because you had to be awake, and they'd have officers on duty that would come on from the 300th MP company, even though I was part of the 560th, and, you know, check the ships to make sure the MPs weren't sleeping and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
But I got lucky, and I got mononucleosis. So they had to take me off ship duty.
Right. All right. These ships, were they primarily American ships or ships?
No, they were from every country you could believe. And the food was excellent.
Right.
And you'd get on a Greek ship.
Right.
Oh. And then you'd get to eat their chow hall and stuff.
Right.
Yeah. No, these were civilian ships that were bringing whatever they brought to Vietnam at the time. I never really looked to see what it was,
mm-hmm.
but they would offload all the stuff at the dock, and you'd stand there and watch them, and you'd be on the water side. I'm not Navy. I don't know what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure there were no frogmen and stuff like that trying to blow up your ship, but we never had any problems.
Mm-hmm. Would the ship's crews be armed as well?
No.
Okay.
That's why they put the MPs on.
Right, okay.
Now, the tugboats were, and they weren't supposed to be, but these civilians that were on these tugboats, these Filipino guys, and man, they had better weapons than we had.
Right. That's why I asked that question. I remembered something about that from the book. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, what were the, you talked about the possibility of frogmen and stuff, but what were there other concerns like mines in the river and?
Yeah, but I, like I say,
mm-hmm.
overstated.
Right.
Not saying it didn't happen, but I never had one incident. Never. Even coming up the Saigon River, where they had Agent Orange, it had defoliated hundreds of yards of vegetation on both sides of the river, so that you know people couldn't get along the shoreline and shoot at you. Never had a problem. Never got shot at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And I know you also talked about in the book during this time period that the Tet Offensive took place.
The what?
The Tet Offensive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Could you talk about what happened there and where you were when all of this took place?
Yeah. The first Tet Offensive, I was on a ship and never got involved. I wasn't allowed to leave the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could hear things going on, and I basically missed it.
Mm-hmm. Where was the ship? I mean, where were you?
The Saigon port.
In the Saigon port. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Could you see and hear things going on?
Well, you could hear. I could hear some things, but as far as seeing anything,
mm-hmm.
no.
All right. Okay. All right. And how long did it seem to last before things calmed down?
The Tet Offensive?
Mm-hmm.
I guess the fighting went on for wow. Because see, I wasn't there the whole time. Because,
right.
You know, going back to Vung Tau and stuff. I guess a few weeks with the Tet Offensive before they got everything straightened out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Once things calmed down, were you able to get off of the ship?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember I don't remember how long I was there at the port while it was going on, and I certainly didn't get off.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The reason I was asking, I was wondering if you had seen kind of the way the people in Saigon reacted to it, or...
Well, I know from my talking with other people that, you know, they'd be fighting, and you'd see a motorcycle with his family, you know, driving down the street.
Mm.
I know on the second Tet Offensive it was that way, but the second Tet Offensive, they never got into the city.
Mm-hmm.
They did some stuff in the outskirts of the city and stuff, but no, the people were, you know, the old looky-loo kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, there's a fight down the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's go watch it.
Right, right. Okay. All right. You were more involved with the second Tet Offensive, right?
Yeah, but like I said, they never got into the city. What I remember responding to rocket attacks, and they would fire rockets randomly into the city and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as any fighting in the city, that was almost all done right on the outskirts. They were stopped at the outskirts.
Mm-hmm. Where were you?
Probably the 9th Infantry Division and units like that probably, you know, bore the brunt of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they did fire rockets and mortars into the city for like, oh, God, it must have been 30 days.
Mm, okay. Where were you during second Tet?
The second Tet, let's see, I finished with the 560th, my 6 months there, and then I extended for the 527th MP Company back in Saigon, which was town patrol, thank God. And I was living in my apartment, although we were supposed to live in the International Hotel downtown,
mm.
which was probably a 10-story hotel.
Okay. All right. So during the second Tet, could you actually see things like the rockets and mortars coming in?
Oh, yeah. The Viet Cong fired one rocket, and I forget what the name of it was, but they fired it out of a tube, and it was like 6 feet long, and it was like it went about 3 miles an hour. I mean, you could see it in the air.
Right.
I'm being facetious. But, yeah, you could see some of these rockets coming in.
Mm-hmm. And did you see a lot of the damage that these things were causing?
Well, the aftermath.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, they had actually fired right into the downtown. You know, some of I don't think they knew where they were firing them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just like sort of a random kind of thing. And like, so I've got a picture on my website of one I took of a car that hit right downtown. I don't recall if there were any people injured, but there had to have been people injured. I mean, Saigon was just too congested to miss something, to
mm-hmm.
miss a person.
Right.
There were a lot of injuries, and you'd get at the scene of maybe a mortar going landing or something, and there would be somebody down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just couldn't miss.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, what time period was it then that you that you extended for the second time?
Well, I was out of the Army in October of 68, so I was there 6 months prior to October 68.
Okay. All right.
And prior to that, I was 6 months with the 560th. And what happened is when you extended, you got 6 months knocked off the time that you joined. Like, I think I signed up for 3 or 4 years. So if you extended for 6 months, they knocked 6 months off of the time you had to stay in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually got a year knocked off my time in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By extending twice.
Right. All right. And you were was it the 527th?
527th. And when I got short, they sent me out to C Company, the 716th MP Battalion. I think I was out there a month. And I think that's, I don't know why, I don't remember why they sent me out. I remember I was the driver for Lieutenant Ribich.
Okay.
And he became the commanding officer for C Company. And he was the hero of the Tet Offensive, taking back the American Embassy. I don't know if you've seen the videos of inside the embassy when the fighting is going on, and you'll see an MP with his helmet off and a cigarette in his mouth, and another MP helping a wounded MP back behind a building. Well, that was Lieutenant Ribich.
Okay, right. I've seen that footage before. It's been a while, but
he died a few years ago. He retired out of the Army. I was able to track him down. He died of congestive heart failure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. you mentioned here that this was mostly town patrols here at this point. Okay. Could you talk just about that and some of the incidents there, if you remember them?
Well, you know, I can remember curfew was Saigon was it was an amazing because during the day you couldn't help but bump into somebody. That's how congested Saigon was. And at curfew, you couldn't see a rat on the street. I mean, it was a ghost town. And Saigon was a big, big city. And I remember one night, it must have been 3 o'clock in the morning, watching this GI walk across the street. And we went up and approached him, and he pulls out this big, looked like Bowie knife.
Hmm.
And we had to take him down at gunpoint. But you got a lot of stuff like that because Saigon in 68, there were supposedly 5,000 known AWOLs, absent without leave,
mm-hmm.
in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of, you know, checking GIs like, you know, hey, what's your unit? You got your pass? And if they didn't have their pass, we took them in and things like that. We spent a lot of time in the bars because there were hundreds and hundreds of bars in Saigon and fights all the time and drunk GIs and assaults and I remember going into one bar where a guy had been shot by an M16 rifle by another GI, and you weren't supposed to have any weapons, though. But it was typical city police work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And this is the time when you were working with the Vietnamese MPs as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What type of work would you be doing with them?
Well, they basically rode in a Jeep with us, and we used them for translating.
Okay.
They didn't get too much. They didn't get involved with their own Vietnamese military. They rode along with us. Oh, I remember once going into a bar in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
We had gotten a call of a man with a gun, and I have no idea why I did it, but I walked into the bar, and the bar was empty except for a couple of Vietnamese soldiers who normally did not go into the American bar. I call them American bars only from the standpoint that that's where all the GIs went.
Mm-hmm.
And they normally didn't go into these bars at all. And he was standing there, and he had a 45 or 38 at his side. Might have been a 38. And he looked pissed off, and there was nobody in the bar. And somebody had said that all the people at bar girls and the GIs had gone to the back. For some stupid reason, I just looked at the guy, and I walked past him and walked to the back and got all the bar girls and the guys and said, single file, follow me out of the bar, and we walked out of the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And my buddy said, God, that was stupid. And I said, I didn't know what else to do. And the thing about that is just a few weeks later, two MPs got shot dead doing the same thing, going into a bar in Cholon, and they were shot as soon as they walked into the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was just lucky. But you know, stuff like that.
Right.
It was fun. I enjoyed it. I have a Canadian friend who was going to college down here and got drafted into the Army, and I met him, Per Christensen, and I'm still in contact with him. He lives in Vancouver, B.C.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I used to do patrol all the time, and we had a blast. It was fun. Even though you'd get in fights and stuff, and, you know, you're 21 years old.
Right.
And it was exciting.
All right.
And we saw a lot of stuff, and we saw dead people and everything, but you know, when you're that young.
Mm-hmm. Right. Were drugs a problem as well? I mean, as far as in the city itself, were you guys dealing with people with drug problems as well?
With what?
With drug problems, things
like that. Well, you know what? I have another friend, John Shumbra, who was there 2 years later than I was.
Uh-huh.
And I had done a couple radio interviews, and they asked me about the drug problem, and I said, you know, I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And although I know it was there, because, and then John called it on the show and said, Jim, it was all over the place. I said, well, what year were you there, John? He said, well, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, see, Woodstock hadn't hit yet.
Right.
And even though it was there for me, it wasn't there like it was for you, because I know that later on it became a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
But and this is one of the things that really irks me about some of the guys who went to Vietnam. They used Vietnam as an excuse for the drug problem. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, they brought their drug problem to Vietnam with them.
Right.
Then they went home and they said, look what Vietnam did to me. It screwed me all up. Well, I say bullshit to that.
Right, sure.
I'm not saying some guys didn't get involved with the drug, but they came there already doing the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess later on, after I left, when I got out in October 68, I guess it got really, really bad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, what about, you talked about things like fights and stuff like that. Were there ever racial issues?
I don't remember those either. I work with a bunch of black MPs. I've got some pictures on our website. I'm on my website of us, you know, mm-hmm. in intense stuff. But that did happen too later when the Black Panthers became, you know, really powerful, and that did happen. I'm proofreading a book that a guy's writing, and where he had to actually shoot one of the guys, a black guy, over. You know, he was into the Black Power salutes and fuck Whitey and all this stuff, and he wound up shooting the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And but while I was there, I just didn't see it. But I know it came later in
right.
the war.
Okay. All right. what about things like? I know later on you're going to be working. You would be working things to do with the black market. But at this point, was any of your MP duties have to do with that at all?
No, we were not allowed to touch anything in the black market. The local police were not allowed to touch anything in the black market. It was all done by the customs police.
Okay.
And the reason it was done solely by the customs police and hands off to everyone else is because it was run by the customs police.
Mm-hmm.
And totally corrupt and run by the higher-ups.
Okay.
Right. How do you explain that I can't get fatigue pants in my own stock room on an Army base and that I have to go to the black market where there's a pile of 50 of them sitting there?
Right.
So we weren't allowed to confiscate anything off the stalls. And the stalls were, it was just like a swap meet. The stalls were there right on the streets of Saigon,
mm-hmm.
right out front, right laid right on the sidewalk. There was no hiding it. It was done all done in the open.
Right. All right. Well, I certainly want to talk more about that in a moment, but before we get to all that, I guess you had been in, towards the end of your, end of this tour, you had been in country about 2 years, right?
2 years. Uh-huh.
Okay. Had you noticed that... Were things changing for the worse at that point? Could you tell if things were going downhill at that point?
Well, not at that point. You have to realize that the guys who were in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
we were pretty much isolated from what was happening in the States.
Okay.
We got to watch Armed Forces TV,
right.
you know, the Lone Ranger and stuff that they put on,
mm-hmm.
and we got to listen to Armed Forces Radio Network. There was no, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we picked up a newspaper, which most of it didn't have time to do because we worked like 12-hour shifts,
right?
I didn't know what was going on back in the States.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I didn't know that they had called the Tet Offensive a huge victory for the Viet Cong when nearly, 50,000 of them were killed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought we won the Tet Offensive.
Right. So I guess you were pretty surprised then whenever you went back home to find out the way the media had been covering the war?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the media lost the Vietnam War for us.
Mm-hmm.
The media and our Henry Kissinger,
mm-hmm.
please.
Right.
Peace with honor. What is that?
Right. All right. I want to talk about some of those things as well before we wrap up some of these broader issues. But okay.
But I think like for somebody like me, you know, I wasn't the guy who was waiting for my year to end and I'm going home, but boy, I'm so glad to leave and go back to the world. I mean, I was happy pulling my duty in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Happy, is that the right word? I was satisfied with it.
Okay.
And I was enjoying it. I loved the experience I was getting, and then I had a girlfriend, so
mm-hmm.
it was like I was in the States. I mean, I didn't see a big difference because I enjoyed what I was doing.
Right. Okay.
Even though I'd seen a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was growing up, I guess.
Right, sir. All right. So one other thing I wanted to ask you about this time, did you Did you ever get a chance to go on R&R or to leave Vietnam at all during these 2 years?
Yeah, I went to Hong Kong once and Taipei.
Okay. All right. Okay. How about things like writing letters back and forth with your family?
I wasn't much of a letter writer. I might write once every week or two. I just, I didn't have a girlfriend to write to.
Right.
I'm sure the guys who had girlfriends wrote every day or whatever, but I didn't have a picture of my girlfriend on my next to my bunk.
Right.
And like I say, we work long hours, so.
Right.
I just wasn't much of a letter writer. Mm-hmm. Although I will say one thing, that the letters that I did write to my friend Chip, who I grew up with, he kept them all and has them to this day.
Huh. Oh, wow.
Yeah, he has a rubber band around them, and they're quite embarrassing.
Right.
You talk about growing up. I look back on what I wrote then and how I feel today. I'm going, oh my God, did I say that?
Right. Okay. Well, when your time in the Army came to an end, I know you said that you weren't excited and fired up about going home. What did you feel then, as far as when it was time to go?
Well, I think I touched on the book. I almost felt like I was leaving home.
Right.
Because I saw and did a lot, and I wouldn't change. But I think most of the Vietnam vets would say this, if they're honest, that they wouldn't change any of that time whatsoever, regardless of the good, bad, and the ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, taken a boy from Fairhill, Maryland, and putting him in that, it worked for me. Mm-hmm. That environment worked for me. It really, I really changed. I grew up, and I had been living in an apartment, learning the Vietnamese culture, and I just didn't feel any attachment to home for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, my older brother was, 11 years older than me, so I don't have very many memories of him, because when I was in the first grade, he was graduating from high school and going off into the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And my other brother, Bob, he went off into the Air Force and, made a life of his own. And my dad had died, so there was only my mom, and my mom had moved back. My mom had moved to all the way from Maryland to Washington State when I was in Vietnam, and I didn't have a real good relationship with my older brother.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to go back to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And there was hell to pay when they found out I was going back to Vietnam without a job.
Right. Right. Okay. Let's see. Well, I'm sorry here. I'm looking at my outline here. So when you returned to the States, I know you talked in the book a little bit about that time period, about how, as you just mentioned, that hell to pay when you returned because you wanted to go back to Vietnam. But when you left Vietnam, did you already know that you were going to be going back?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. How long were you back in the States at that point?
Long enough to get my visa and passport. So what was that, maybe a month?
Okay. Right. All right. Okay. And was it primarily your relationship with Mai that made you decide to go back? Okay. All right. Okay. How difficult was it to get the visa and to return?
Not a problem at all.
Okay.
To go to Vietnam? Not a problem at all.
Right. Okay. All right. I know you mentioned one thing in the book. You talked a little bit about how you didn't have enough money to buy a round trip ticket or
yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I got my out pay. I was a sergeant when I got out of the Army, and I seem to recall my out pay was like $500 or $600,
uh-huh,
something like that.
Right.
And the airplane ticket chewed up just about every bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
Back then.
Right.
And I had no intention of coming back anyway, so I got to customs in Hawaii, and a customs officer asked to see my passport and my visa and my round-trip airplane ticket. And I said, well, I don't have a round-trip airplane ticket. He said, well, you can't get into Vietnam unless you can show that you have the ability to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I didn't know that. He said, yeah, you have to have a round-trip plane ticket.
Right.
So I didn't know what to do. If it wasn't for him saying to me, why don't you go to the counter and get a one-way ticket out to Bangkok, it'll cost you about $50.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I said, that way, if you get there and decide you don't want to go to Bangkok, you cash it in. I said, oh, thank God bless you. So I went and got a ticket to Bangkok, got to Vietnam expecting them to check my passport and visa and all that stuff, and they didn't even check me when I got off the plane.
Right.
The Vietnamese customs. I just walked out of the airport, and then I cashed in the ticket to Bangkok.
Right. How long?
Well,
was...
I would not have been able to go had I had to come up with another $500.
Mm-hmm. Right. How long was the initial visa for?
It seems to me that it was like something like 14 or 16 days is sticking in my mind, and I remember it took me about a month to find a job, and I went over to the embassy and said, it's amazing. Hey, I'm here visiting my brother who's in the Army.
Uh-huh.
Can you extend my visa? Sure.
Right.
And they did it, and I walked out, and like, God, that was easy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And how difficult was it to find a job?
Oh, first I had no idea where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I lucked out one day because I was remember feeling pretty despondent, and there were a bunch of Filipino guys who lived below us, and they were playing cards, and they said, well, why don't you go over to the PX and check with the PX? So I thought, oh, geez, I never thought of that, because I didn't know that they had civilians. Well, of course they did.
Uh-huh.
So I went to the PX headquarters, and I remember a lady saying, oh, you were in the MP. She said, well, Major Oaks, I remember him, is starting up a security branch, and get in my car, and we got in her car, and we drove over to his headquarters in Cholon, his office in Cholon, and I walked in, and I was the first, myself and an Australian guy were the first civilians hired in country to start up a security department for the post exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So I lucked out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Could you talk a little bit about your duties there, specifically what your job was?
Yeah, there were like 150 post exchanges throughout Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And that included the snack bars and everything. So I remember this, that he said, well, you don't know, he said, Jim, this is brand new, we're just trying to get this off the ground. And he brought in the post exchange manual and the Department of Defense manual, and he put it in front of me, and he said, write me an audit checklist. And I said, well, what's an audit?
Right.
He said, well, something where we can go into these facilities and use a checklist to make sure they're following all the rules and the procedures. So I must have sat there for a good week or so going through these manuals and just looking at a paragraph that says, in accordance with da-da-da-da, you'll do this, and putting them into a checklist format. And that's how it basically all got started. And then as investigators, we would go out to these exchange facilities all over the country and go in and do audits to make sure that they were following the proper, you know, handling of cash, pricing of goods, control of ration cards, and things like that. We didn't worry about shoplifters. That wasn't one of our duties at all.
Mm-hmm.
We were like auditors and went around to the depots and looked through the depots and said, oh, you've got to fix this, you've got to fix that, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It later turned into an investigations-type unit, too.
Okay.
Because the black market was getting so bad.
Right, right. Okay.
Although we didn't do any black market investigations, we did it within the purvey of how is the exchange affecting the black market, the post exchanges.
Right. And what did you find out about it as far as the corruption there and how?
Oh, it was just we used to follow convoys.
Mm-hmm.
And the convoys of the post exchange, like it would leave Saigon Depot.
Okay.
And there would be an MP gun jeep and an MP gun jeep in the back, and just maybe 20 trucks, big long flatbeds. And they would snake their way through Saigon going 5 miles an hour because the trucks were loaded. And we would follow a truck that would turn off down an alley, and the whole damn truck would be offloaded by the local police and people in civilian clothing. And then they'd even sell the truck.
Mm, wow.
They'd keep the truck. We would find trucks with post-exchange markings on them being driven in Saigon, but they were painted. But you could still see the markings.
Right.
But we had no authority to stop and detain any of those because it was run by big shots. It wasn't run by, you know, like in the United States, everybody thinks it's a small-time dope dealer that's doing, that's got all the power. No, it's run by people who you got to keep your hands off of.
Right.
And ration cards. I remember this one post-exchange manager of going in and searching his hotel room one night. And he must have had a stack of 50 brand new ration cards in his room that he was no doubt handing out to his friends who were coming into the post exchange, not even buying the goods, and walking out at the front door with the goods to sell them on the black market. And the way they would do that is you'd walk in with the ration card, you'd be the people who worked inside the post exchange had to be local nationals. They had to be Vietnamese. They couldn't be American soldiers or anything. So you'd walk up to the counter, and there'd be a girl at the camera counter who was working with you. You'd hand her the ration card. She'd punch one camera. You'd walk out with it without paying. You'd walk back in. She'd use the same hole. She'd punch the same hole. You'd walk out with another camera, and it just went on and on and on. And the Vietnamese loved Martell cognac. Martell cognac was expensive on the street. But you could tell when Martell cognac was in the post exchange because there'd be 100 guys standing outside the door waiting for this to open. Because you could buy the Martell cognac for $3 in the post exchange, sell it for 12 on the street, and the people who bought it for 12 would sell it for, what, 20 or whatever. Mm. It was just completely out of control.
Mm. Right. Right.
And we were overwhelmed by it. We had hired like 6 new investigators. So that probably gave us a staff of about 12.
Hmm.
But before that, we probably had 5 or 6 investigators, and it was just way too much. I remember going out to Tain Inn, which was next to Zeon, to the post exchange out there, and their cash fund was short, you know, $60,000. But what do you do?
Right.
You know, you go to CID and say, hey, would you take a look at this? Because we can't figure it out. It's just gone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They'd have ships going into the Delta with post exchange goods on it, and they would pull up alongside the shore, small crafts, pull up alongside the shore and offload the goods and stuff. It was amazing.
Right.
Black marketing in the military payment certificates was what we got paid in. We didn't get paid in greenbacks. It's basically what made me leave.
Mm-hmm.
And not only the fact that the fact that I'd also been there 4 years when I left.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned that it wasn't your authority to do anything about the black market. Whose authority was that to deal with?
That was the customs police.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And even as a post-exchange investigator, I would go out and look at the black market, and I would see stacks and stacks and stacks of cartons of cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
I would see our goods sitting right there on the street, and I couldn't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were slick, because what they would do is they... you would read the, somebody back in the States would read the paper, black market raided Saigon streets, I don't know, $1 million worth of goods confiscated, blah, blah, blah. But what they would do is they would tell these people the day before, we're going to raid you,
mm-hmm.
put out some token stuff for us, we'll come do the raid, the press will come take the pictures, they'll put it in the paper, everybody will be happy, and tomorrow you can start your business up again.
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what was happening. The black marketers would lay out stuff. Okay, here, take this, take these cameras and stuff, and the custom police would take them, and then the next day they'd bring out everything else that they had,
mm.
stack it up a mile high, and start selling again.
Mm. Wow. All right. Well, you said that that a lot of these people that were running it were big shots. That people were, you know, people that you really couldn't touch. Were there, to your knowledge, were there ever incidents where some of these guys were prosecuted for what they were doing? Or?
Well, I know that there were some officers who were. I know that there was a big problem in the clubs over there. Were a sergeant major of the army or something like that over there at the time? I certainly don't want to indict.
I think you're right about that. I have heard the story.
But the same stuff that was going on in the clubs was going on tenfold in the post exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
I got sent up to Da Nang, to that exchange up there, and watch people walking out of the post exchange with flatbeds full of stuff, and nobody was checking them.
Mm.
And so we went in and got a flatbed and walked in and loaded it up with TVs and stuff and walked out the front door with it.
Right.
And we're going, what the hell is going on here, folks?
Uh-huh.
You need a door checker.
Right.
Okay? But the thing was, even if you put a door checker out there, if they're in cahoots with the people who are coming in, and here's where the 5,000 AWOLs in Saigon come into effect,
mm-hmm.
they're going to walk in, get the stuff, and the door checker is just going to ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was grand theft on the grandest scale.
Wow.
I understand that at one time, what would happen with an AWOL in Saigon is the ones who, the hardcore AWOL guys, and not just the guys who were gone overnight or for a couple of days, but they would be fixed up with a girl, they'd be fixed up with an apartment, they would be fixed up with the ration cards, and they would work in a cahoots with the people in the PXs. They'd also be hooked up with drugs. And I know that there were GIs found dead of drug overdoses in these apartments.
Mm.
But they would work with, in cahoots with these people to get that merchandise out of the PXs.
Mm. Right. All right. Did you ever have any run-ins with AWOLs?
No.
Okay.
As an MP?
As an MP or during this job.
I know that we got robbed on patrol.
Okay.
Stuck up and got robbed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah. And I, from the post exchange side of it, as a civilian, the guy who had the 50 ration cards
mm-hmm.
was just sent home.
Hmm.
Nothing was done to him. He wasn't prosecuted.
Wow.
I guess it was just easier to say, you know what, you're fired. Here's your plane ticket home.
Right.
You know, you'd go in and you would check time cards, and you'd pull the time cards out, and you go, where are all these people?
Mm-hmm.
And here, what would happen, for example, like the PX manager's girlfriend was getting paid even though she didn't work at the PX.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Because he was punching her time card every day.
Right.
And that happened a lot, too. If it could be defrauded, it was defrauded.
Right.
Where there ever was a will, there was a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just flat out ridiculous. I think if people knew the scope of it, they would have gone, oh, shit, this war should have been shut down a long time ago.
That brings up the next question I wanted to ask you. Did you kind of look at that from a broad view and say this is kind of an indication of what's wrong here?
I don't think I was that sophisticated at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Looking back, yeah.
Right.
But at the time, I had tunnel vision, you know, post-exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at it from the broad aspect back then, no, I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell by, could you see kind of the effects that all of this was having, I guess, on the Vietnamese economy?
Well, it was thriving.
Uh-huh. Right. Oh, well, I guess so, yeah.
Everybody had a refrigerator. Everybody had a TV. Everybody had a stereo. Everybody had a camera.
Right.
I mean, it was just, yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. All right. How long did you, how long were you in this job?
I was hired in January of 69, and I left in July of 1970 and came home.
Mm-hmm.
So a year and 7 months.
Okay. All right. And I know this is getting close to the period where the American drawdown has begun to take place. Could you notice that?
No, I never paid attention to it. Once I was working there as a civilian, uh-huh. I was working six days a week, 10 hours a day.
Right.
So the war to me, I just didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know you also talked in the book, this is about, I guess this would be about the point when your relationship with Mai was beginning to sour a little bit.
Well, you know, when I said I wasn't seeing the effect of what was happening, I knew that the end was probably getting near, but
okay.
things were sort of getting out of control
uh-huh.
in Saigon. And, you know, I had gone back there to specifically get her and bring her back to the United States.
Uh-huh. Right.
And she wouldn't go. And later on in life, when I talked to her in 2004 or something like that, you know, she said, well, you know, I was only 16 when you met me. And I was like, what? You know,
right.
I couldn't believe that.
Right.
So she was just too young. And And, you know, her feeling was that the Americans were going to be in Vietnam forever, and I liked Vietnam, and why not just stay there? But I sort of knew otherwise, and I also sort of knew that I was, I had to go back to the States because I didn't know, I guess I didn't know what was there. Mm-hmm. And if I stayed too long and then I went back, I would be so out of touch with everything,
uh-huh.
and I would be so far behind everybody else. And then, but what I didn't realize is when I went back, I was so far ahead of everybody, so far ahead of everybody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, mentally and as far as experience.
Right.
You know, I was no longer naive when I went back home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
As naive, I should say.
Right. And at what point in your, at what point here was your daughter born?
She was born in, December or January of 1969 or January 1970.
Okay.
Off the top of my head, I'm having problems recalling it.
Sure, sure. Okay. All right. So when was it again when you actually left?
I left in July, the end of July 1970.
Okay. All right. And could you talk about, your return and your impression of the U.S. at that point and your family's reception of you and all of that.
Say again?
Could you talk a little bit about your experience of your return to the States? And
oh, I was lost. I was completely... As soon as I got off the plane in Seattle, I wanted to get on another plane and go back to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I was used to the warm weather, and I got off the plane in Seattle, and it was overcast, it was raining... It was damp. It was wet. It was muggy. I mean, I got off the plane and went, oh, man, I don't think I'm going to like this. I didn't like it from the time I stepped off the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you why. Just I was in unfamiliar grounds. To me, I was in foreign territory. I was, no offense to my mom, but I was back with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean, from an independent standpoint.
Right, sure.
I had been independent for 4 years. I was back to, you want to eat, you want to, you know, let me make you a sandwich, that kind of thing. I was back to a domineering brother. All the things that I didn't like, I was, in my life for myself, I was back to that because I had been independent for 4 years and done my life and done some wonderful things and learned some wonderful things, done some not so wonderful things. But it was just like I was 15 again, back home. Nobody asked me what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
Right.
Nobody said, how was my, how's the baby, how, what did you do there? Nobody asked. Nobody uh-huh. wanted to know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think in the book I said it was like it was Monday and I had just left Friday.
Right, right.
So there wasn't much to talk about.
You said when you first got back you were wanting to get right back on an airplane, but did you really think that you would eventually be going back again?
Well, I did for a while,
uh-huh.
And I remember getting in touch with my buddy Purr up in Canada, who is now out of the Army, and we went up to the pubs and would drink beer and stuff, and we had actually got in contact, and I can't remember who it was. With somebody back in Vietnam, and the job offer was to go back to Vietnam and run some convoys into Cambodia, and I guess it was surreptitiously, and we just sort of looked at each other like, no, that's probably not a good idea.
Right.
But as far as, you know, I didn't call, because see, I landed in Hawaii for a week and visited my civilian boss lived in Hawaii, so when I went back home in 1970, I stopped at his house for a week, and I don't know why, but I should have gone right down to the PAC, it's called PACEX, Pacific Exchange, Asian Exchange or something. That's the headquarters for all the exchanges in the Orient,
mm-hmm.
and I should have gone over there and said, hey, I'm an ex-security specialist, and you got a job. I should have done that, but I didn't. I went to Hawaii for a week and then went home, and I really had a tough time
mm-hmm.
when I got home.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like anybody. I didn't like the girls.
Right.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm. All right. How long did it did it take you to adjust, I guess?
Well, my buddy Chip moved from Maryland out to Washington, and we decided that we were going to go to community college in Seattle. So we went to, and I did find a girlfriend, Chinese. Mm-hmm. Can you believe it? I found a girlfriend, and I can remember my mom saying, and don't get me wrong about my mother. I love my mother and everything, but she said something to me that finally made me realize that I needed to get out of Bellingham. She said, well, you're not going to marry her, are you? And I said, well, why? She said, well, she's Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, okay.
Right.
So, well, but anyway, I wound up going to college down in Seattle for a little while, and then I finally just left this Washington State and drove down to San Diego.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you follow what was going on in the war after you got back?
I don't think I did, because in 1970, it was just more of the same kind of thing for me.
Right.
And I don't really recall sitting down and going over a newspaper and checking out, well, you know, this battle and that battle, because I'd been there and done all that and basically knew what was going on, so no.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And during this time, had you made any attempt or anything to contact Mai or anything?
Yeah, I tracked her down in 2004.
Right.
I had a friend who was an Amerasian. An Amerasian is a child born of an American soldier, and who lived in Baltimore. And I got in touch with her through the internet because I was doing some searches and just happened to find her. Mm-hmm. And she told me of a guy who lived in Denmark who still worked with the remaining Amerasians in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in touch with him, and he said he had an office in Saigon, and he said, do you remember your address? I said, yeah, 195 Trung Minh Key. That's where I live. For some reason, it's like remembering my army number, RA13993849. Mm-hmm. You just don't forget it.
Right.
So I said, yeah, I remember. He said, well, I'll send my worker out and to your address. So this was in, had to have been 2004. So he sent his worker out to my address, who emailed me, whose English was absolutely terrible. And at that time, he said that my daughter had died of the sick.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't. He wrote something like, daughter dies sick. But he couldn't explain to me what that was. So he had told me that Mai's cousin Dal, who lived in the apartment right next to ours, had married. I know what. He put me in touch with a girlfriend that remembered me, and she emailed me, and that surprised me too, because I didn't know they had the ability to do that, to get emails out of Vietnam to the States. And she said that Dow had married a guy with the last name of Kelp, K-E-L-P, and lived in Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, God, that can't be too hard to track down. Kelp is not a common name.
Right.
So I did an internet search, and Kelp came up, one name came up, Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, that must be it. It wasn't Dow, but it was Bruce Kelp, her husband. I didn't know what her husband's first name was.
Right.
So I emailed him and kept emailing him, and then I phoned him. I was and kept phoning him, but I was never getting an answer, and found out that he had a ranch out in the country someplace, and he never went to it but maybe once a month. Finally, I got a phone call from him and said, hey, I'm sorry I didn't return your phone call, but I just got here to the ranch and the answering machine. So I was able to talk to Dow, and Dow confirmed that my daughter was killed in Vietnam, and said that Mai had escaped Vietnam with her Vietnamese husband in 91 and taken a boat to the Philippines, and was in a re-education camp there for a year, and was living in Dallas, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So the internet certainly brought the world a lot, you know, smaller and closer, that's for sure.
Right, right.
Because without the internet, I wouldn't have, there's no way I would have found out.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I know this is probably a stupid question, but how difficult was it just to hear this news?
To what?
To hear the news, to finally hear.
Oh, it, you know, we left behind 50, it's estimated 50,000 children, and here I'm the one guy who searches for his daughter.
Right.
And this happens. It was really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But here again with the incident that happened with my daughter in the end of the book.
Right.
It did help me tremendously. And I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't hallucinate.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly helped me out.
Right.
Matter of fact, I wrote the last chapter of the book before I even started the beginning of the book.
Hmm. Wow, okay. All right. So, and I won't go into it because I don't want to, you don't want to give away everything in your book. But so was that kind of, was that inspirational, I guess, for you to write the book then?
Yeah, I thought I had to do it for my daughter. And I also wanted people to realize another side of the Vietnam War. And, of course, this happened in World War II. It happens in every war where there are relationships and children born, but you just never hear of that. It's always the blood and guts, the guts and the glory and the killing and the gore. And I had to write that, and I didn't even know where to start. I thought, well, where am I going to start this thing? So I thought, well, nobody knows how we grew up back in the 50s. My stepson still doesn't believe it. That you could not have, how boring could that have been? When I tried to tell him it was not boring, it was absolutely wonderful.
Right.
To not have the pressure that you kids have today and not have to stand there and text somebody every 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I had to write that, and I had to do some things with my dad, and it sort of went full circle from my dad to my daughter Fung.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the book, because they were both tragedies.
Right.
And, you know.
All right, sir. Okay. Well, before we wrap things up, then, could you talk just a little bit more about your life after Vietnam? And I know you mentioned that you were a police officer. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I got a job I got a job with the security department in a retail chain in San Diego, about 13 stores. I just happened to walk in and got hired, and I they were basically concerned with shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went in there with my knowledge and said, look, you know, you've got all these cash offices, and you know, you've got merchandise coming in improperly marked. There's, you know, that's how shrinkage and shortage happens. You've got employee theft, and I took what I had learned in Vietnam and came up with checklists and audits and things like that. And they said, "Oh, great!" So I became an auditor for that retail chain.
Mm-hmm.
And ten years there or 11 years there, the department store finally closed all 13 stores. So prior to that, I went out to the Navy Exchange at Miramar, NAS Miramar. They had a position as a security manager, and I went out there, and they hired. I was the last person they interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And I even had a beard. I walked in with a beard. And I walked in and said, you know what, I think I made a mistake coming here with this beard on it, because I was in front of a lieutenant commander and a civilian personnel manager and the other security manager who was at one time a career Navy guy. And I thought, I said, this can be shaved off like tomorrow. And they said, well, they interviewed me, and they said, well, what do you think is the biggest cause of inventory shrinkage? I said, well, it's not shoplifting, it's employee theft. And the commander said, bingo, you're hired. He said, everybody we've had in here has said, oh, we've got to catch the shoplifters. He said, I want somebody who can go out and audit these facilities and look at this thing and go to the small exchanges that have the that sell gas and try to find the fraud in the selling of the gas and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, the only thing is your resume sucks. He said, who did your resume? I said, I did it. He said, well, it's awful. he said, I can't send this to New York for approval. Go out and get it professionally done and have it back to me in, I think he said, 2 days.
Uh-huh.
And they hired me, and I worked out at NAS Miramar, and then they were having problems in Puerto Rico, and they said, we'd like to send you down to Puerto Rico to work down there at the Roosevelt Roads. So they sent me down there, and it brought back memories of Vietnam. It was so friggin' corrupt. Oh, God, it was corrupt.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. And I quit. I thought, this is Vietnam all over again. I said, I'm here on a 3-year contract. This is what I was not told. I said, you either get me out of here, or I'm going to blow the whistle on this whole joint.
Mm-hmm.
They had me on a plane within a week, had professional movers come into my nice apartment on the beach and packed me up and got me out of there.
Right.
I came back to the States looking for a job, and I went over to the school district, and they were hiring community service officers for the school police department. And I got hired on there, and the chief of police there said, "Jim, I want to send you to the academy. We can use guys like you." And so they sent me to the police academy. I worked all day at the school, and then at night I went to the extended academy for a year and became a police officer. And then just as I got my post certificate, they had a hiring freeze in the school district. And my wife is from Mexicali, Mexico, down here in the southeast corner of California, and she said she'd like to be closer to her family if she could. So I came down here to Brawley and got hired, and retired out of there in 2000. When did I retire out of there? 2003 or something like that. 2002, 2003.
Okay.
And that's it.
All right. Okay, and then you soon after retiring, is that when you began working on the book?
Yeah, soon after that. I have my own website, and that kept me busy for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I also I'm a big baseball addict. I love baseball. I've got that MLB extra innings, so
right.
There's always a baseball game on here in the back room that I'll be watching. But I got involved in the video gaming, making rosters for downloading under the PlayStation 3 for guys who play the baseball games. I make the rosters for them and stuff. And
okay.
And that kept me busy because it's quite time-consuming and quite detailed, and I have fun doing that,
right.
Working with statistics and things like that. So.
Sure.
I even got invited up to the Sony studios in San Diego last year.
Oh, cool.
To preview their new baseball video baseball game they put out on the PlayStation 3.
Uh-huh.
And they had me up there for 3 days. And
right.
Got to test run it and everything. That was a lot of fun.
Hmm.
It keeps me young.
Sure, absolutely. Who's your favorite team?
Well, I really don't have one. I follow the Washington Nationals only because I used to follow the Washington Senators.
Okay, right.
So I follow them, but I enjoy watching just about any baseball game. I think the other night I was watching Yankees in Texas, and it doesn't matter to me, really.
Right, sure. Okay, all right. Well, before wrapping things up, if I could ask you some broad questions about the war, and you can say as much or as little as you'd like here, but looking back on your experience as far as your experiences in Vietnam, how do you feel about your own participation in the war and about American participation in general?
Well, my own participation is I'm pretty typical of most of the GIs that served there, I think. We went and we did our job with honor. Most of us were good guys. The majority of us were good guys. We did what we were told, and we came home with honor. As far as the country's handling of the war, it's our biggest embarrassment. We basically abandoned Vietnam. We walked out on them. I think what bothers me the most is we left all our weapons and planes and armament there for them to use, but then Congress cut off the funding, and they weren't able to get their planes off the ground. They didn't have bullets to shoot. They didn't have mortars to fire. They've broken down helicopters because they couldn't get parts replacement. So we secretly, without much fanfare, screwed over Vietnam in the end and said it was peace with honor. It wasn't peace with honor. It's our most embarrassing moment, I think, ever. It really upsets me what we did. And I think the other thing that upsets me that's come out of the Vietnam War is the stereotyped post-traumatic stress soldier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Only 1 out of 10 guys in Vietnam did the fighting.
Right.
2.5 million men served, and 500,000 have filed for post-traumatic stress claims.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the math, it doesn't work.
Right.
We have a lot of guys that, for whatever reason, have decided to use post-traumatic stress to get some money out of the government for a problem that wasn't even caused by Vietnam or what they did in Vietnam. And it cheapens those guys who really suffer from the dramatic, violent things that they had to do against a man's, nature. And that really bothers me. I have talked to many, many, many vets, and there are few of them who weren't like the guy in the letter to his girlfriend in firefights every night, and the death and destruction all around them. Vietnam was not like that. It was, I think one guy said one time, it was 2 or 3 minutes of sheer terror followed by hours and hours and hours of boredom, random boredom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was from almost everybody who served over there. And the post-traumatic stress thing really, really bothers me, because I don't like to see those who need the help cheated by having to serve those who maybe got involved in drugs 5 years later and said, hey, I'll just blame Vietnam, because if you look at TV, that's what it says. Drugs were rampant.
Right, right.
And it just bugs me.
Yes, sir, sure.
But I'll tell you, the guys I served with, 90% of them, they could come eat in my house any day of the week.
Right, right. All right. Well, what do you think about, do you think that the U.S. Should have been involved to begin with? What's your view?
I think it was an honorable thing. I mean, if you look back then, the spread of communism, you know, the domino theory, it was, I think, a noble undertaking at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion, but boy, we sure didn't go about it the right way.
Right.
You know, if you're going to fight a war, you fight a war. I mean, and I'm afraid that Afghanistan is, we're not going to get out of Afghanistan, and we're not going to get out of Iraq with the way we're doing things right now.
Mm-hmm.
You either go in there and bust the place up and fix the problem, or you get out, and I don't know.
Right.
The politicians that are involved, and I don't know if you read a book called The Only War We've Got.
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
It was written in 1970.
Okay.
I just reread it for the second time last week.
Hmm.
You ought to pick it up.
Okay.
And it's satirical, but man, is it spot on. I mean, it'll have you laughing, it'll have you scratching your head, and you say, yeah, that's true. Because it really touches on some of the absurd shit that went on over there. I mean, just the post-exchange in itself, there was absolutely no control.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was, at the end, everybody was making a dime.
Right. Now, this is kind of a difficult question, but why do you think that things were so corrupt and things were just, as you said, absurd, this absurd stuff going on? Why do you think that was?
I just think everything got off track.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Just like today, anytime you hit the government, get their hands in everything,
mm-hmm.
things go to shit.
and
that's what was happening to Vietnam. Oh, let's build another post exchange over here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's build another facility over there. Let's put some more people here, and it gets unwieldy. It gets too big to control. All you need to do is get a handful of dishonest people in there,
mm-hmm.
and it just goes all downhill. And you can see what's happening today. I don't want to get into the politics of the today, but
sure.
you want to see FUBAR, just get the government involved in more stuff.
Right. All right. Okay. And I know you mentioned a little bit earlier your thoughts on the media coverage of the war, but could you talk a little bit more about that? And particularly, if you could talk about how, just the impression about how, after you got back to the States, because I know you said when you were there, you really couldn't tell what the media was saying, but once you got back, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know if I really jumped into reading the news.
Right.
It's just the stereotypes that I saw. I mean, your movies were stereotyped. About the only thing I saw that was of any importance to the press was, oh, good, another hippie spit on another soldier.
Mm.
It was that kind of stuff that was in the forefront. It's just like today. There was no good news. I have a buddy up in Escondido who says when Iraq first started, he said, gee, it would be wonderful to hear if we're killing anybody in Iraq, any enemy soldiers, because you're not hearing a thing. I said, no, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a purpose behind that. And I can't really say that I looked at the paper and said, damn this. I've looked at the paper since then,
mm-hmm.
as I've gotten older, But it was just the whole feeling that, you know, when I got off the plane and when I got out of the Army, I had my Class A's made for me, my sergeant stripes put on, my medals put on my chest, and I didn't want to walk out of the terminal, so I went and changed into civilian clothes because I didn't want to face some idiot hippie coming up to me and saying, you know, baby killer. Because those were the people getting the press, and those were the people who were emboldened. They went out and, you know, they made the scene because they knew they were going to get their picture in the paper.
Right.
That's just,
right.
I don't know.
Yes, sir. All right.
Make me president.
Right. Right. Okay. Another question for you. What do you think about the U.S. policy towards Vietnam today and this developing relationship that we have with
Well, I think we need to. I mean, the Russians moved in,
mm-hmm.
and the Vietnamese called the Russians Americans without any money.
Right, I've heard that quote, yeah.
And, you know, Cam Ranh Bay, I guess, is one of the greatest seaports in Asia. And it's a wonderful country with people who work extremely hard.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have a relationship with them. I don't know how our government's going to pull that off, but they have they have resources there, and I'd say let's do it. Let's bury the hatchet, and 'cause they still love Americans,
mm-hmm.
most
right.
of them.
Right.
They're welcome back fondly when they go back. They aren't bitter about us walking out on them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go to Little Saigon here, up in Orange County, you know, you've got American and Vietnamese flags out all over the place. You know,
mm-hmm.
very patriotic, still anti-communist.
Right.
But they love their new country, America, and if you go back, you're treated well and with respect. So yeah, let's.
Mm-hmm.
I say let's do it.
Right. All right. Well, speaking of that issue of going back, I know towards the end of the book you talked about the possibility of going back one day. Have you or have you thought more about doing so?
Well, yeah, and you know, it's a 21-hour plane.
Right.
And I've got some back issues and really bad knees, and if I sit too long,
mm-hmm.
Standing me up is like an old Erector set. And it's just, I'm not really good at flying anyway. I told my wife, I said, after our last plane flight, before we had some turbulence, I said, I don't think I'm getting on another plane. I said, I'd rather die here on the ground. But I would love to go back, but the plane flight?
Right, sure.
I really don't know. And I've talked about it. I even talked about taking my stepson back.
Mm-hmm.
With me, and I just don't know. I probably should, but I don't know. I have a fear of flying.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's probably what's holding me back. Because I certainly look at the photos of Saigon today on the internet, and my God,
mm-hmm.
just Vung Tau itself. Vung Tau looks like the French Riviera. There was nothing there when I was there.
Right.
And it has a million people. A million people live in Vung Tau. I bet you there weren't 30,000 that lived there when I was there.
Oh, wow. Right. All right. Well, and before wrapping up, is there anything else you want to say, anything else we should cover?
No. Just, again, if you could shoot me an email and
sure.
give me some info about the where I can find the project that you've doing now and what you've done in the past, because I sure like to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely.
But, you know, keep in touch, and if there's any more info I can give you, I've got to start a new military police website because GeoCity's shutting down.
Right.
So I've got to restart that.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, let me go ahead and stop the recording, but if it's okay, I'd like to talk to you for just a few more minutes.
Okay.
After